This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
In ordinary times, the idea of a former US president entering a Georgia county jail to be charged with a plot to overturn an election result would seem unthinkable. But these aren't ordinary times. Donald Trump has already been booked in New York, Florida, and Washington, D.C. on a myriad of different criminal charges. He, of course, pleads not guilty to all of them. And a lot of the American public, at least those who will vote in the Republican primaries, don't seem to care. A recent poll had Trump 46 points clear of his nearest Republican challenger, Ron DeSantis. Trump feels so comfortable, he even skipped this week's candidates debate in Milwaukee. Winning politically is one thing. Winning in the courts is another. How likely is he to be convicted? And more importantly, even if he is convicted and possibly has to serve jail time, will that stop him from serving a second term in the White House? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Firstly, your handy bullet point guide to the cases Donald Trump is currently dealing with. Joining me in the briefing room is Sarah Smith, the BBC's North America correspondent, who's in Atlanta. Sarah Smith, can we just talk through the list of legal cases against Donald Trump? And I'll tick them off as you tell us what they are.
Yeah, I'll run through them quickly because there is a lot to get through. So the most recent indictment against Donald Trump was in the state of Georgia, where he's accused of election interference and trying to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in the state of Georgia. There's another case in Washington, D.C. that's been brought by the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, which is also looking at the aftermath of the last presidential election. And in that, he's accused of attempting to overturn the results and, as a result, defraud the people of the United States. So that is all sorts of things that happened after the presidential, up to and including the January the 6th riots. He's also been investigated and indicted by that special prosecutor for withholding classified documents and having secret documents at his residence in Mar-a-Lago that he'd taken from the White House that, firstly, the prosecutor says he has no right to have, and also that he tried to obstruct justice by not handing them back. And then in New York is where Donald Trump received his first criminal indictment, and that is over hush money payments that were made to an adult film star, Stormy Daniels, and he is accused of fraud there because it may have violated election rules, the way she was paid to stop her talking about an affair she says she had with Donald Trump. Also in New York, there is a second defamation case being brought by a woman who was sexually assaulted by Donald Trump in the 1980s. She won one case already where he was found to have committed sexual assault against her, although not rape. And that is about to be litigated again. And another case in New York is against the Trump business, where he is accused of inflating the value of his assets to try and get better terms for loans, including claiming his apartment in New York was much, much larger than it actually is, as well as pretending it was worth more money than it really is.
Sarah, let's look at the politics of this for a moment. What has the effect been on the Republican primary election?
You might have thought it would dent Donald Trump's campaign to be re-elected president. Certainly, that's what everybody thought before it happened. But each indictment has boosted his popularity among the Republican base to the point where it is now central to his campaign. He makes a great show every time he turns up to be arrested or arraigned, with reporters embedded in his motorcade. He brings TV cameras with him on his plane on Trump Force One as he flies in to face arrest. He shouts from his social media platform, Truth Social, against the weaponization of the justice system and says that he is the victim of a political witch hunt here, accusing the president of deliberately targeting his biggest opponent in order to try and knock him out of the presidential race. And this is a tactic which has been enormously successful. Firstly, it means that Donald Trump gets all the attention all the time. And almost the only thing you hear from the other candidates is when they're asked whether they support Donald Trump or not. Would they pardon Donald Trump if he's convicted and if they're elected president? Do they agree with Donald Trump that the 2020 election was stolen from him? You hardly get any debate about policies at all from Mr. Trump or from any of his opponents. And he is able to say that he is being targeted because Joe Biden is frightened that he is the only man who can beat him. So it makes himself look unassailable practically, at the same time as claiming he is the victim, and that's why he's being put under arrest in four different cases.
Now, that's, of course, in the eyes of Republican voters in the primaries. What is your judgment about whether or not these indictments and possibly any guilty verdicts which could happen, or not guilty verdicts which could happen before that election, might have on the general electorate, particularly swing voters?
So this is the big question. Every pollster, pundit and politician is trying to answer at the moment. And I've met a lot of Trump supporters, people who really like to see him back in the White House, but who are worried about nominating him as the Republican candidate because they just don't know how all of these legal problems will play with swing voters and independents. Can they reach beyond the Trump base and persuade people who didn't vote for him in 2020, who sent Joe Biden to the White House, to move back to Trump, even when he is facing all of these indictments? There are people who are convinced that actually he can ride this all the way to the Oval Office. But there are more who have got really serious doubts about whether this makes him unelectable. But of course, the Republicans who will vote for their candidate, the ones who take part in the primaries, very rarely worry about electability. They want somebody who agrees with their policies, who they are ideologically aligned with or at the moment, whom they just feel passionately defensive of, which is where Donald Trump is. So not everybody who's going to be casting a ballot on who their candidate should be is particularly worried, really, about how it's going to play in the general election.
How's this likely to look if and when he's up against Joe Biden?
Well, Donald Trump and many other Republicans spend a huge amount of time pointing out the legal problems that Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, has. Now, they are of a totally different order from the crimes that Donald Trump is accused of. Hunter Biden is in trouble for non-payment of taxes, for lying on an application for a gun license when he said he wasn't taking drugs when in fact he was. Potentially, there might be some trouble over whether he had correctly registered his foreign business interests. So this is minor compared to the stuff that Donald Trump's going to be in court for, but everybody is talking about it in the US. Every time you ask a Republican, are you not worried about Donald Trump's indictments? They say, oh, well, what about Hunter Biden? And it looks now as though he will be going to court and facing a trial next year during the presidential campaign as well. So already in voters' minds, it has become as though everybody has legal problems. Now, of course, it's not Joe Biden who's going to be in court at all. It's his son. But yet it's all aligned together into a position where voters are left thinking, oh, well, they're all at it, and therefore may not punish Donald Trump for being the one who finds himself in the dock.
Sarah Smith. Right, let's take a closer look at the most recent developments in some of those cases and try and rank them in severity. Returning to the briefing room is Renato Mariotti, a legal affairs columnist for Politico magazine, a former federal prosecutor and host of the It's Complicated podcast. Renato Mariotti, we last spoke on this programme back in April, and it seems like a huge amount has happened in the 4 months since then. Can we start with the election tampering case in Georgia, which has all come out since we last spoke? What are the recent developments, and how serious do you think they are for Donald Trump?
Well, there has been an indictment in that matter. That's a pretty serious development. 19 defendants charged, and many different charges. Really, I think it's safe to say that the prosecutor in Georgia, a state prosecutor, not a federal prosecutor, made the decision that she was going to throw the book at Trump, so to speak. She was going to charge everybody she could. She was going to charge every crime that she thought she could charge. So, you know, if, for example, Jack Smith, the special counsel who is bringing federal charges, was working with a scalpel, I think she was working with a sledgehammer, the Georgia prosecutor, just doing whatever she could. And I think it has some significant consequences. It has consequences, obviously, both for that case. I think that case is going to take quite some time to get to trial because of all the defendants and charges. But there are also potential consequences that it'll have on the other cases, given the individuals who were charged. And we're already seeing, of course, litigation by some of those individuals who are trying to move their portion of the case from state court to federal court. I expect that those motions will ultimately be unsuccessful.
Can you just very quickly explain what the difference is between a state brought case and a federal case?
There are essentially parallel systems of criminal justice in the United States. There are certain offenses that are charged by states, and then there's a variety of federal laws that include criminal laws that are prosecuted by federal prosecutors, which I used to be. So you have state courts, state judges. Ultimately, the pardon power rests in the governor, or in the case of Georgia, a pardon board under state law. And so it's just purely a different system of justice.
Let's move to the Mar-a-Lago documents case now. Are there any latest developments there?
Yes. So first of all, there was a superseding indictment since we last spoke that added an additional defendant to the case and added additional detail regarding obstruction of justice. The reason I think that's very important, first of all, there are now two of Donald Trump's, you know, lower level workers who are charged along with him. And that means that there's a potential that one of them could potentially cooperate against Trump down the line. Secondly, it's apparent that there's already cooperators, including the IT person from the Trump organization, who is going to testify that there was a conspiracy to destroy evidence. And third, I think that the problem for Trump is the more that there's evidence of obstruction of justice, it's harder for him, I think, to argue that he didn't think he was doing anything wrong. You know, his defense is that, oh, I had all these classified documents in my bathroom and my ballroom because I thought that was totally fine to do. But if you really thought that that was completely legal, then why are you trying to destroy the evidence when the FBI comes?
So that all looks as if it's got a little bit more sticky for him.
Indeed.
Let's move to the January the 6th, 2021 attack on the Capitol building and the charges which are related to that. What's happening there?
So there has been an indictment in D.C., a federal indictment. Unlike the Georgia case, which I described as sort of a sledgehammer, this is more of a scalpel. The only defendant is Donald Trump. There are other people who are alleged to be conspiring with Trump, but were not actually charged as defendants. And I believe that's because the prosecutor decided that he wanted to get to trial as soon as possible before the election and made a determination that having a single defendant case would be more likely to move quickly. He also charged just a limited number of crimes. He sidestepped crimes he could have charged that would have given rise to a First Amendment defense, a free speech right. And then he also carefully wrote around, I would say, Mark Meadows. In other words, Mark Meadows is the former chief of staff to President Trump, and he is conspicuously absent, even though he was in the middle of everything. And I suspect that that means that he's likely going to be a witness for the prosecution. That's a very problematic case for Trump. It's not as straightforward and easy to prove as the Mar-a-Lago case. However, the judge in the D.C. case is much less favorable to Trump. And as a practical matter, it really looks like that's likely to be the first federal case, at the very least, that goes to trial, if not the first case that goes to trial altogether.
Now, Renato, when we spoke back in April, you told me that you thought the Mar-a-Lago classified documents was the most serious one that Donald Trump faced. Since we've had the Georgia indictments, does that remain your view?
That has not changed my view at all. In fact, what I would say is that the Mar-a-Lago case is a complete slam dunk for the government. The only thing that has helped Trump and has gone a little bit in his favor is that he has drawn a judge in Florida who is very, very favorable to him and went out of her way to help him in a prior proceeding related to the Mar-a-Lago case. She did so in such a problematic way that it drew a lot of criticism and ultimately a rebuke from the Court of Appeals. So I think the only thing I can say that is helpful to him in that case is he has a judge that's favorable to him. The evidence itself is absolutely damning.
Okay. Now, How is Trump's defense team dealing with all these cases simultaneously? I mean, does he have multiple teams working on all these things or some kind of Trump defense central?
He does not have the number or quality of lawyers that he needs to properly manage all of these cases. You know, I represent clients now at a large law firm, and I have much less serious single cases that I have more lawyers on than he has on, you know, a whole slew of cases combined. And the quality of his legal team is uneven. So I think he's not equipped to handle all these cases at once. And I do think they have collateral consequences on each other. For example, those other 18 people charged with Trump in Georgia, they very well could be witnesses in the District of Columbia, the D.C. January 6th case. But obviously, given that they have their own legal jeopardy, they're much less likely to become witnesses. And so I think that there's an interplay between these that really helps the prosecutors and does not help the defense. And that's just another challenge that he has to face.
You've hinted at one or two of the answers to this question earlier, but can you talk me through the time frames here? Do you think there are going to be trials and verdicts in any of these cases before the November 2024 election?
No one knows for sure. What I would say is the only two that there's any chance of that happening are that Manhattan case that we talked about, the New York case, or regarding the hush money payments, or the January 6th case. I don't really regard the Manhattan case as as big of a threat to Trump. I think in the January 6th case, if he's convicted, there's a potential of very, very serious charges there. And so I think that as a practical matter, a lot rides on whether or not that trial happens before the election. In a typical case, I would think that that trial would not occur before the election. However, the prosecutor, Jack Smith, has done everything possible to ensure that that case goes to trial before the election. He clearly is very eager and energized to make that happen. And the judge is not very favorable to Trump and has made it pretty clear that she wants to move this case quickly as well.
If I had to ask you to bet on whether it would get there before November 2024?
It's probably a coin flip.
But the other two, the documents and Georgia, they, in your view, definitely come through after the election.
That's right. I can't imagine a circumstance in which those trials occur before the election.
If he was elected, what are his options then? He's elected, but he is convicted either before or subsequently or both.
In the federal cases, he can do one of two things or both, which I think he might do both. He could appoint an attorney general who's corrupt, who decides that he wants to quash the cases against Trump, essentially ordering the Justice Department that would be under that attorney general's control to stop prosecuting Trump. That's one option. Secondly, he could try to pardon himself, which has never been done before in the United States history. It's not clear that he can do that, but he could try. I suppose he also could take a more moderate view that the cases are just paused during his presidency, but I don't expect Trump to do that. As to the state cases, however, the Manhattan case and that case in Georgia, his attorney general could not directly stop those cases, and he could not pardon himself because the president can't pardon state offenses in the United States. And thus, his lawyers, and presumably will be the Justice Department, would have to make the argument that the president of the United States can't be prosecuted by a state prosecutor while he's in office.
Are you saying if Trump gets elected, essentially he can put a stop to all the federal processes?
He can. And obviously that would be unprecedented, highly controversial, corrupt, and possibly illegal. But it's hard for me to see how there would be any enforcement mechanism to stop him from ending the federal prosecutions against him.
But he has no such power over the state cases.
That's right. His power would be indirect. He would have to direct the Justice Department, or his attorney general would direct the Justice Department, to go to state court or to federal court and make an argument that Trump could not be prosecuted by a state government because he is the executive branch of the United States government and thus, you know, could not be prosecuted by a state at that time. But no court in the United States has ever considered that issue because no president has ever been the subject of a criminal prosecution before.
Renato, quite a few of those options seem to me to be likely to end up at the Supreme Court anyway.
Yeah, very possibly the case. Certainly if he tried to pardon himself, certainly if you try to quash the indictments. One thing that is this is revealing about our system is some of the weaknesses and chinks in the armor in our constitutional system, because typically speaking, the rights that one has regarding a criminal prosecution are on the defense side. In other words, Trump is the criminal defendant. He would have rights to argue about the government's actions. But if the prosecutor exercises his discretion to do something favorable to the defendant, it's actually a very challenging thing to bring to court. And while it's corrupt, I'm not sure who would prosecute the attorney general for an act of corruption.
Renato Mariotti. And just before we move on, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the whole back catalogue, including the one about whether we can meet the net zero challenge, the one about the AI revolution, and the one about how we deal with a rapidly ageing world. Which is as good a segue as any to the next US presidential election and Donald Trump's legal problems. I now want to talk about something that's provoked a lot of conversation in recent days. It's the idea that Donald Trump could be barred from running again for president under a clause contained within the Constitution. Kermit Roosevelt III is Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Pennsylvania Carey School of Law and author of The Nation That Never Was, Reconstructing America's Story. He joins me down the line from Nova Scotia. Professor Roosevelt, the big question, boiled down, what is the U.S. Constitution?
The Constitution is our highest law. So it's a written document, and it creates the federal government. It says what the government can do. It says some things the government can't do. And it also talks about who can be a part of the government.
Which part of the Constitution determines whether Donald Trump could possibly be disbarred from running for president?
That's the 14th Amendment, which is not part of the original Constitution. The original Constitution was written in 1787. Then a bunch of amendments, what we call the Bill of Rights, were added in 1791. And then over the years, there have been more amendments. And in particular, there was another bunch after the Civil War. And that's what this is a part of.
So this one came in after the Civil War. Can you tell us why they brought it in?
Well, so the Civil War was a conflict between two parts of the country, the North and the South, where the South wanted to leave. And the rest of the country, the North, wouldn't allow that. So we fought a war. The North won. It turned out we were going to stay as one country, which meant that the Southern states were going to be reintegrated into the Union. And as part of that, they were going to be able to send representatives to Congress to serve in the federal government. But that posed a problem because they were going to have numbers almost equal to those of the loyal representatives. And it wouldn't make much sense if, having fought a war to defeat these rebels, we then allowed them to take over the government.
Which bit of the Constitution relates to the suitability of a person to hold office?
It's Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which says if you took an oath to support the Constitution, which you have to do if you're a federal or state official, so if you had served in government before, and then you violated that oath and engaged in an insurrection against the United States, then you're barred from holding office unless Congress, by a majority vote, lets you back in.
Does it define insurrection?
It doesn't define insurrection. And that's one of the things that people have been talking about, because it's not clear how to understand that term.
Some very distinguished people argue that Donald Trump has already fallen foul of this with his behavior so far, and therefore would be or should be ineligible to run. And others say that isn't the case. Can you run me through their respective arguments?
There are basically two arguments here. One is about the substance and one is about the process. So on the substance, the question is, what does insurrection mean? Do the events of January 6th count? And if they do count, did Donald Trump participate? Did he engage in the insurrection? So that's a question of what the intent needs to be and whether violence has to be involved and how direct a role he has to play. And I think on most of those questions, the argument is pretty strong. January 6th was an attempt to prevent the lawful transfer of power, to install someone as head of the government who wasn't entitled to be the head of the government. That does seem like an insurrection to me. There is a question about the extent to which Trump participated. Maybe, but the information that's coming out now suggests there was a real plan to do this and he was very much involved. So maybe the more persuasive questions are about process. So does he have to be convicted of a crime for this to operate? Or does Congress have to make some kind of finding? And who are the officials who will be implementing this ban if the ban does apply?
Does he have to be actually convicted of a crime before somebody can raise this question of eligibility?
So there's no indication in the Constitution that a conviction is required. And we know in terms of how this was applied in the past, after the Civil War, and it very clearly did bar former Confederates who had held federal office from resuming their place in Congress. What happened, and I think the really important lesson of history, is that Congress stopped excluding these people. Congress let them back in.
And how would somebody actually go about trying to get Trump disbarred? What's the process?
Probably the answer is it goes the same way as the other qualifications. So the Constitution sets out other qualifications for president. You have to be at least 35 years old. You have to be what the Constitution calls a natural-born citizen of the United States. It's a little bit unclear what that means. People argue about whether it means you have to be born in the United States or simply a citizen from birth. But we've had disputes over these before. So what happens is the rival campaign, usually someone, a political opponent, will go to the Secretary of State from some state who determines whether candidates are eligible to be on the ballot and says, you can't list this person's name. They're not over 35, or they're not a natural born citizen. Or in this case, they took an oath to support the Constitution and then they engaged in insurrection. So each of those should theoretically be enforced the same way.
Let's say somebody from the Biden campaign goes to the Secretary of State of a particular state, let's imagine it's New York State, and says, you've got to take Trump off the ballot for the presidential election because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment.
So we can imagine a friendly state like New York, I mean, friendly to the Biden campaign, or a hostile state, you know, they could do it in Alabama. But either way, the Secretary of State makes a decision. And either they do allow Trump on the ballot or they don't. And then presumably whoever is disappointed sues. And then eventually the lawsuit goes up to the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court would have the final word.
Can I imagine for a moment that that process would be expedited quite quickly because of the proximity of the election?
Yes. I think that's a situation where you would get judges who realize they have to decide quickly in order to avoid completely skewing the political process.
What would happen at the Supreme Court if such a case were brought before the presidential election?
Well, it's very hard to predict because nothing like this has really happened before. I mean, as I said, there were people who were excluded from Congress after the Civil War, but those cases were all pretty clear. And it was clear that's exactly what the constitutional provision was written for. So now, where you've got one person and they're the leading candidate for the nomination of one of our two major political parties, it looks a lot different. And I think it's very hard to say what would happen. I think the Supreme Court would probably be hesitant to intervene in the democratic process. In terms of the legal question, did he engage in an insurrection? There's a pretty strong argument, yes. But I would give the odds that the Supreme Court ends up excluding him from the ballot at maybe 20 to 30%.
Kermit Roosevelt. My thanks to him and to Sarah Smith and Renato Mariotti. And my conclusion, can someone please find a new word for unprecedented? The Briefing Room will be back next week.
You've been listening to The Briefing Room. The presenter was David Aronovich. The producers were me, Ben Carter, Diane Richardson and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden, and the programme was mixed by James Beard. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. And if you're interested in American politics, I can recommend the BBC's Americast podcast, which is available on BBC Sounds. This week, the team are splitting their time between Atlanta, where they're covering Donald Trump's arraignment in Georgia, and Milwaukee, where the Republican debate took place on Wednesday night.
From BBC Radio 4, morning. A new fiction podcast.
I want you to hold something for me.
Hold something.
A holiday in Dubai.
The missing Korean telecommunications tycoon was found dead this morning.
Takes a deadly turn.
A guy you've never seen before offers you 10 grand to look after an envelope, and you take it.
Tell nobody. Not even your girlfriend, okay?
There's something I need to tell you.
It'll save a lot of lives if you help us.
This is all a terrible mistake. We just want to go home. We don't want to...
Shut up!
Available now on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.